Harvest Messages are brought to you by Harvest Partners. To receive free email daily devotions or to become a Harvest Partner, please visit us online at harvest.org.
Well, I've jokingly titled this message, My Short Career in Making Gallows by Haman. But who doesn't like a story that where the bad guy gets it in the end, right? Yeah, this is really getting exciting. You know, everybody loves a movie, a revenge movie, you know? And this is certainly a story that's kind of got those elements. But, you know, there's also other parts of this story that are fascinating. You know, many times it's the small, seemingly minor details that end up leading to some of God's greater purposes. It's like pulling on a loose thread. Have you ever done that? You ever get a sweater and you snag it and you figure, I'll take care of this, and you pull on that loose thread, and before you know it, the whole thing's unraveling and you got a big hole in your sweater. Or you decide maybe to paint one wall in your living room, and then before you know it, you've painted the rest of the living room, and then the carpet needs to be changed, and when it's all said and done, you've redone the kitchen. You know, it's little things kind of lead to other things. And life is like that, right? Sometimes small, benign occurrences end up changing the course of our life. And I think of one small word of encouragement that I was given in college that really changed the direction of my life and where I was heading. I think of a guy by the name of Errol, a Muslim guy in Albuquerque who was depressed and suicidal and ready to take his life. And he drives to find his drug dealer, buys enough drugs that will allow him to overdose, and then he decides he wants to have some music to die by. So he begins tuning in his car across the radio dial, ends up on a Christian station. Here's an ad for the Albuquerque Harvest Crusade. And as he's driving, he looks up and he's passing the stadium, the arena. Providence has it. He drives in. He gets saved, radically changed. And we end up meeting him some 10 years later in Chicago at our crusade there, where he's then helping and serving in the crusade. Or I think of a young man by the name of Marcos, who I met last week. We went to Peru to work. We're looking at working with Compassion and sponsoring children through our crusade ministry this year. And this young man, as a seven-year-old, had a seven-year-old friend that kept inviting him to church. And he wanted him to come to church and to find the joy that he had as a seven-year-old. And Marcos kept telling him no. He would rather go out on Sundays than play soccer with his friends. And but the young boy wouldn't stop. And one Sunday he shows up at his house and Marcos sees him coming. And he tells his parents, tell him to go away. Tell him I'm not here. And so they do. Marcos comes outside 2 hours later, and there is David waiting for him. And with tears in his eyes, he invites him to church again. And Marcos says, okay, I'll go. He goes and, of course, falls in love with it. He gets involved in the Compassion program, after school program that they have. He ends up coming to church. For several years, he and David, they become best friends and grow in learning about Jesus and making friends there in the church. And then throughout this whole time, Marco's parents are upset. They don't want him at church. They don't want him going there. And then one night as he's in church, his mother shows up at the church and Marco sees that and he's excited. But then he learns that she's only there to take him home. Well, what he finds out is that his mom had cancer. And the doctors are giving her 6 months to live. So he goes back to the church and asks them to pray. And they do. And miraculously, she's healed. And she has, she begins going back to the church because they were the ones that prayed for her. Marcos continues to grow, and through his teenage years becomes part of the worship band. His mom's part of the church. His dad, who was an alcoholic, ends up getting saved. His brothers and sisters end up getting saved. All because of one boy's tears. All because of a word of encouragement that I received. All because Errol flicked the radio dial and found a Christian station. And so here in our story, the lack of sleep, a sleepless night, leads to information about an unrewarded deed, stopped assassination, which leads to the revelation of a wicked plot to exterminate God's chosen people, which leads to their salvation. And it all begins with a sleepless night. That night, the king could not sleep. So he ordered the book of Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. Once again, as we've seen throughout this book, the hand of providence comes into play. Some would call it coincidence, but we know that there's no coincidences with God. Literally, this meant the sleep fled from the king. Why couldn't he sleep? Could it have been indigestion from the wine at the banquet that day? Was it something that was weighing on his mind? Could it have been that he was concerned about another plot to overthrow him? Was that the reason that his attendants read to him from the record of 5 years earlier where there was an assassination plot? Well, we don't know. We can't say. It doesn't say. But what we do know is that God got the attention of the king at just the right time. History shows, the Bible teaches, that God worked through Pharaoh. God worked through Cyrus, another Persian leader. God worked through Nebuchadnezzar, another Persian leader. And here he's working through Xerxes. You know, I believe God is sometimes busiest in the night seasons. Have you ever had a night season where something's just weighing on your mind and God wakes you up, and all, at least what I can do, is just go and maybe grab the word and start reading and say, Lord, speak to me. Those are great times. And I think if ever you're in that situation, that's what you want to do, is just grab the word and start reading and let the Lord speak to you. But due to his sleeplessness, Xerxes calls his attendants to read from them, from the annals of history. Now, it's easy to make a joke about this and say, well, you know, he just wanted to get put back to sleep, so he's reading history. It could be true. I don't know. I kind of think Xerxes was actually interested in how history was being written about his reign. Maybe it was a concern about some plot that was being hatched that he wanted to know about further. But whatever reason, these royal attendants read to him about Bigthana and Teresh. They sound like a couple of mafia guys, don't they? Bigthana and Teresh. And they were gonna kill the king. But what we see here is the clear hand of providence. Ahasuerus then is motivated to reward Mordecai for his loyalty. Because, look, when you were a king in that era, you needed loyal people around you. Assassination attempts were not rare. So he was very likely looking over his shoulder. But Haman's hatred towards Mordecai could have hindered his sleep. Xerxes probably was hindered because of this concern. All of these characters had a reason, I think, to to be concerned and have a sleepless night. But most of all, Mordecai and Esther had the biggest reason, right? Because their people were facing genocide. But the difference was the troubles of Mordecai and Esther drove them to their knees, while the troubles of Xerxes and Haman drove them to evil deeds and human manipulation. Mordecai and Esther committed their destiny to the workings of God. Xerxes and Haman attempted to control their futures through their own activities. Look, far better it is to commit an unknown future into the hands of a known God than to forge a future with our own resources. The second and most fascinating part of this story is the incredible timing that we see in these 14 verses, things that happen. Now, I recall a story about a girl who was asked out on a date, and she had dolled herself up, put on her best dress, put on her makeup, did her hair. She was all ready to go at the time that her boyfriend was to pick her up. And as she's there waiting, she continues to wait and wait and wait. Finally, an hour and a half go by, and she just realizes, he stood me up. So she goes and takes off the makeup, puts on some PJs, gets comfortable on the couch with a snack, and as soon as she does, the doorbell rings. She gets up, walks to the door. There's her boyfriend. He takes one look at her and gasps and says, I'm 2 hours late and you're still not ready? Well, timing is everything. And we find that in this chapter as well. Verse 3, what honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, well, who's in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected for him. And his attendants answered, Haman's standing in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. Now, here's an incredible intersection in time of man's intentions and God's interventions. Haman's excited about coming to work that morning to bring his murderous plot to Xerxes. Xerxes is excited to finally get the opportunity to honor the man that saved his life. And the object of both of them, Mordecai. It's comical, really. So here in the court of the king, their paths and their purposes cross. As I said, it's been said that timing is everything, and never is that more in effect here. Timing is important in many things. If you play sports, you know that's important. If you play music, timing is incredibly important. It's important in communication. It's even important in engineering and building things. Timing's always a factor. As this chapter opens, Haman's intent is to murder Mordecai. Xerxes' intent is to honor Mordecai. But in the course of a few minutes, Haman is forced into a place of honoring Mordecai, and Xerxes will be moved to a place in where he wants to murder Haman. Talk about a reversal of fortunes. You know, sometimes God uses time to work out the circumstances in our lives. And sometimes God uses circumstances to work out his timing in our lives. The timing of God's clock is always perfectly synchronized. The gears of God's clock go tick, tick, tock, granting rhyme and reason into every man's walk. A little ditty that you can remember. You know, it's also interesting here that the king apparently was unaware that Haman had duped him when he signed that declaration that would exterminate the Jews, the race of Mordecai, for whom now he wanted to honor. He clearly knows now that Mordecai is a Jew. If you read verse 10, he calls him Mordecai the Jew. So it's a reminder again that God's timing is always perfect in when people get the information they get. He worked through the circumstances to reveal Haman's wicked plan at just the right time. You know, God is never in a hurry, even if it means he just shows up in the nick of time. He knows, and he does it for our purposes and our benefit. It says of Jesus, when the time was just right in Galatians, he sent forth his son into the world. God waited in the history of man to send Jesus at just the right time. All of God's delays are his maturings, either in time, Psalms 37 says, be still in the presence of the Lord and wait patiently for him to act, or his maturings in us. Psalms 119, 67 says, I used to wander off until you disciplined me, but now I closely follow your word. So be it timing to work on us or timing to work on circumstances, God is in control. This is the perfect example of God uses the intentions of men, be they wicked or honorable, to work toward his ultimate goals. So let's move on now to the next movement of this chapter, and it's all about pride. Verse 6, 7, 8, and 9. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, well, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. It's so good. Proverbs 16:18 says, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Oh, Haman's fall is going to be fast and hard. Standing before the king, he is so blinded by his own arrogance that in the span of seconds, his intention to murder Mordecai becomes secondary. I mean, you could imagine him walking quickly into the courtyard early in the morning with a spring in his step because he's going to kill Mordecai. What a good day it's going to be. And then all of that wickedness disappears when the king greets him and says, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? And Haman immediately thinks, the king wants to honor someone, someone who is loyal and faithful. And he never pauses to consider anyone else. His self-conceit is so blinding. There was never a thought it could be anybody else but him. So he rolls out the greatest honors he could possibly think of. Give that man a royal robe the king has worn. Put him on a horse that the king has ridden, one of the best horses, and have that horse have the royal crest on his head. Clearly, Haman is creating a dream scenario, probably imagining himself one day as the ruler, the emperor of that land. I love some of me, I could hear him thinking. Haman, meet a man. Me, me, me. He was the original me monster. All about Haman. You know, God knows how to deal with prideful men. I think of the story of Nebuchadnezzar. It's a fascinating testimony of Nebuchadnezzar. If you read Daniel chapter 4. In that chapter, he says of himself, is this not the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? Indeed, it was a great feat. In fact, it's still, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon are still one of the seven wonders of the world. But here he stands taking all of it in and putting it all on his shoulders, all that he had done. And then as the chapter goes on, it tells us how he was immediately driven away from the people, ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like feathers of an eagle and then his nails like the claws of a bird. God knows how to deal with prideful men. And after 7 years of this living like an animal, Nebuchadnezzar writes, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever." And at the same time, it says that his sanity was restored, his honor and splendor were returned to him, and his kingdom was returned. And then the chapter ends with this: "And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble." Wow, what a story. God knows how to deal with our pride. And that's a fearful thing, because it's one of the great sins. In fact, one of the best books that I have ever read, and I recommend it all the time, is a simple book called Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And it has impacted the lives of so many people. I've heard mention this book. But one chapter is called Pride, the Great Sin. And C.S. Lewis in that chapter writes this: "According to Christian teachers, the essential vice, the utmost evil, is pride. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all of that are mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind." That's quite a description of pride. And he goes on to say how we can identify pride. He says, "If you want to find out how proud you are, the easiest way is to ask yourself, how much do I dislike it when other people snub me or refuse to take any notice of me or shove their oar in or patronize me or show off? The point is that each person's pride is in competition with everyone else's pride. It is because I wanted to be the big noise at the party that I am so annoyed at somebody else being the big noise." Isn't that so true? Does that not describe Haman? He was so afflicted by Mordecai that it just rubbed and grated on his pride. And don't think that because we're saved by his grace that we're immune to this sin. In fact, religious pride can be the worst and most subtle of sins that plague us. Lewis goes on to write in that chapter, speaking of religious pride, "We pay a penny's worth of imaginary humility to God to get a pound's worth of pride toward our fellow men." Isn't that true? We want to position ourselves to look so humble before God, and we want people to see that. But that's what we're feeding, is what other people are seeing. He goes on to say, "Whenever we find our religious life is making us feel that we are good, above all, that we are better than someone else, I think we may be sure that we are being acted on not by God, but the devil. The real test in being in the presence of God is that you either forget about yourself altogether or you see yourself as a small, dirty object." It's better to forget about yourself altogether. Now, it's been my observation that the truly humble man or woman is the man that, or woman that doesn't think they're humble at all. In fact, they're surprised that other people would see them as humble because they know the true condition of their heart. True humility is being honest with yourself, honestly assessing all of your motives, all of the things that are quietly hidden behind the veil of your life, vulnerably presenting yourself to God with all your weaknesses and fears. Pride is a dangerous sin. And the best way to avoid it is just to recognize it. And when you see or you sense in your own heart that animosity towards another brother or sister, I always remind myself, I'm getting upset because of my own pride, not because of theirs. And it's a great warning sign. Well, now it is time for some poetic justice. Verses 10 to 14. Yes, revenge time. It's great to see the bad guy gets what's coming. As I said earlier, Hollywood lives off of these types of films. Gladiator, Patriot, John Wick, Gran Torino, Tombstone, even kids' ones, Home Alone. We'd love to see the bad guys get it in the end. It's just a feeling of exhilaration when truth and justice triumphs over evil. So in verse 10, he says, "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended." So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai, led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor." I imagine he probably wasn't all enthusiastic when he said that. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends everything that had happened to him. And his advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of the Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." And while they were still talking with them, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. Oh, I put this under the topic, give a prideful man enough rope and he'll hang himself with it. You know, some people like in their management style is to micromanage, to try to control someone else with rules or constant directions. In my opportunities to manage, I've always preferred the concept of management by rope. You know, give enough rope or enough space for people to use their gifts and their abilities, and either they'll fail or they'll succeed. And most often, those who think more highly of their abilities end up knee-deep in trouble. They hang themselves on their own gallows. We can only imagine how devastating it would have been for Haman to lead Mordecai around the city to the praise and adoration of all those people. Now, it should be noted here that when he talks about the gallows that he had built, that it wasn't most likely the type of gallows that we see of people hanging on a rope. It was actually more likely a long pole. This was 75 feet high, a long pole that they impaled the person with and then propped them up for everyone to see. That's more likely what it meant to be hung in this culture. So poor Haman never suspected that he was building his own death device. And then, as if to pour salt into the wound, his own wife leaves him with these encouraging thoughts. "Since Mordecai is Jewish, you can't stand against him. You will come to ruin." Hey, why are you telling me that now? Would have been nice if you'd said something yesterday. Oh. But the truth she uttered is pure gold. For God knows how to protect his people. When God is for us, who can be against us? As believers, we can trust that God will always avenge those who come against us or come against his plans. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." So we're best to leave it in his hands and do as Mordecai and Esther did. Hit our knees, fast and pray, and watch God work. Father, we're so grateful that we are under your plans, under your protection. And that, Lord, you know how to deal with prideful men that come against us. So, Lord, we look to you as the one who is the author and the finisher of our faith. Lord, may we be strengthened, and Lord, may we avoid the pitfalls of pride. Lord, may you help us to be truly humble servants before you. And so, God, we commit ourselves to that serving and to that attitude. And we ask all of these things in Jesus' name. Amen.